From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Health Secretary's described the rising number of elderly people in England left to grow old alone as a national shame. Jeremy Hunt thinks entering old age should not involve waving goodbye to dignity. He's calling on families to look at how they treat their relatives. Jackie Condon runs a sing and dance along class for older people at lunchtimes.
When they get to about 50, 60, they're put on the scrap heap, then they're all alone and they've got nobody to help them. But coming to the class, they meet friends, they actually go out with these friends afterwards.
An inquest has found neglect contributed to the deaths of five elderly residents at a care home in West Sussex. The coroner ruled there was institutionalised abuse at Orchid View in Copthorne. Royal Mail is now worth £5 billion. That's up 50% on its flotation price a week ago. The government's facing claims it undervalued the company with its initial share price of £3.30. Today, they topped £5. Michael Hewson's a stock market analyst.
If he pitched it too high, say like Facebook, for example, that share price halved in the space of 3 to 6 months. And I think the last thing Mr. Cable wanted to do was put off the small investor.
Firefighters say it's too soon to rule out suspicious circumstances at a house fire which killed a two-year-old girl. They say no fire alarms were fitted in the home in Conninsborough, South Yorkshire. Libby Jane Hornsby died in hospital after being rescued from the house last night. More than 140 people have complained after receiving texts accusing them of being in the UK illegally. The messages from the Home Office told them records show they didn't have the leave to remain in the UK. And the Queen has described the campaigning work of Pakistani teenager Malala Yousafzai, who survived an assassination attempt by the Taliban, as wonderful. The pair met at Buckingham Palace. That's the latest. I'm Lindsay Brown.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCMM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. News is Clevedon teacher and NUT elected member for the union's national executive on the, in the South West, Anne Lemon. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, if you're not in a traffic jam already, slow down a bit and ask yourself, who's in control of the car you're driving? If it's one of the newer Audis, a Mercedes, Ford or Toyota or any other with a computer in between you and your accelerator, brakes or steering, your car might decide not to do what you tell it to do. This week, Ford in Germany announced they've developed a system to predict a crash and intervene to stop it happening. But what if it intervenes when you don't want it to, or your car is hacked? As Auto Week magazine does this week, we ask who's really in control of the car you're driving. And was the death of award-winning investigative journalist Michael Hastings back in June really an accident? Plus, nuclear waste agreements have been rolled over despite failures by the contractors. How can that be safe? And BMW are in the news again as a €700,000 bung to Angela Merkel's Christian Democrat Party in Germany helps block new emission limits being proposed by the EU. And as Labour leader Ed Miliband pledges to freeze energy bills, hey presto, energy companies put their prices up and it's us that's going to freeze. Also, Bristol citizens are turning empty offices into homes, their plans rumbling into action. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows tonight, 12 degrees Celsius, but dry. This weekend, highs of 16, generally cloudy, but wetter and windier on Sunday. Next week, highs 16 Celsius, a fairly cloudy week with plenty of showers and some gusty winds. Next weekend, 26th and 27th of October, highs of 16 Celsius, some sunny spells and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is a Clevedon teacher and the NUT's elected member for the union's national executive in the South West, Anne Lemon. Hi, Anne. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, you were on strike, I take it, yesterday?
Yes, we were. We had a very successful strike yesterday.
How can a strike be successful? Because actually, isn't it a failure when you've come to the situation where you're having to strike?
The way in which it was successful is that we feel a lot of teachers actually got together to express their anger and their frustration at what Michael Gove and the government are attempting to do to education and teachers. We came to the strike, obviously it's a last resort, it's not what we wanted to do, but when we did do it, we wanted to have some sort of impact, and we think the 3,500 teachers that marched through the streets of Bristol yesterday certainly had an impact.
Well, the Education Department and Michael Gove will say what you're doing is actually you're starting to poison the relationship between the teachers and the Department of Education, because there are negotiations going on. This is surely not the time to strike.
The real problem with that is it's actually not true. Since July of last year, we've been attempting to have reasonable negotiations with Michael Gove, and he's blank refused to have any form of negotiation. And in fact, as early as last week, the unions actually approached Michael Gove and asked him for more negotiations, and they would have called the strikes off. And it's Michael Gove that just doesn't want to consult with us at all.
Okay, so what's he planning in his department?
Well, there's three parts to this, really. The first part is that the government are insisting that instead of teachers retiring at the age of 60, which they are able to do at present, they need to retire at the age of 68. And that's got huge implications, not just for our members, but for young people in schools. I mean, can you imagine a 68-year-old trying to be part of and look after 16-year-old students? It also cuts the job market and away from the feet of young people who want to come into the teaching profession. The second part is about the actual conditions of service. What we've got Michael Gove attempting to do is to remove our conditions of service, and every school will have a different set of conditions of service, a different length of the school day, different holidays, and we think that's an absolute key for disaster. And the third part of it is pay, really. We've had a pay freeze, as a lot of many other public sector workers have. But on top of that, he's actually going to cut the incremental pay awards that teachers are given at present. And by 2014, this means that teachers will have had a 14% cut in their actual pay. And we're really concerned about what this will do to stop teachers from entering the profession. And we all recognise that whatever we say about education, what really matters is well-qualified, motivated, good teachers in front of children.
Now, at the end of the day, Anne, back in 2010, the people voted for a Conservative, well, not necessarily a Conservative government, but a coalition government with the Conservatives and the Lib Dems, free up teaching. I mean, you know, you obviously come from a quite left-wing perspective where you think that there should be this uniformity. But what they're saying is, and they've really, I suppose, most obviously done this with free schools, is we want to free the system up. We want to actually have different schools able to educate in different ways, with maybe different curricula, different hours during the day, different emphasis on sports, different emphasis on languages perhaps, and that is actually an inevitable result of what was decided by the people actually back in 2010.
Well, I don't think we should be using free schools as a good example. I mean, we've seen two results in the last week, one in Pimlico, where a 27-year-old young woman was actually made the head teacher, who had never taught before in her life and has now been removed. And we've seen the other example where we've had a school condemned by Ofsted as being unsafe and full of unqualified teachers. So free schools, and if we talk about freeing up education by allowing children to be taught by unqualified teachers, that isn't a good thing. Schools have lots of innovative abilities and powers at the moment, but we need to have some level of protection for staff as well, because if we don't have highly motivated, well-qualified teachers in schools, it ain't going to work.
Tell us a bit about yourself, Anne. What made you get into teaching? Were you from a family, perhaps it was parents that did it, or what was it that attracted you to be a teacher?
Well, I'm one of those lucky people who in the 1970s was one of the first people in my family to actually go to university, because in those days we didn't have to have student loans and we didn't have tuition fees, and I got a grant and I could afford to go to university even my parents didn't have a lot of money. And at university I got a real interest in my subject, a love of chemistry, and it made me want to pass that on to young people and become a teacher. And I felt over the years it's been a very, very satisfying job. And the reason why we're taking this action now is it's becoming a bit of an impossible job, really. And the big bit of evidence for that is that 50% of very young teachers leave the profession within the first 5 years. And on the demonstration yesterday, it was very, very young, because those young teachers, the way I was when I was a young teacher, love it, are really inspired by it, but know that what's happening and the risk that they may end up having no incremental and no pay structure to move through the profession is going to stop them from being able to stay in it.
I mean, you mentioned your demonstration, thousands of teachers there, but what is that actually likely to achieve? I mean, surely you would achieve more by actually teaching children rather than going out on the streets and marching around.
Well, you see, if you just we've been teaching the children for years. We've been trying to negotiate with the government. They're not listening to us. Michael Gove has refused to listen. So we're at a very last resort, and it's not just a one-day strike. We are having a campaign of action to make this government listen. And I actually believe that we're not the only set of public sector workers who are beginning to say this government's got to listen. And we've only got to look at the FBU, the CWU.
That's the fire brigades and the communication
workers. And the communication workers.
The Royal Mail people.
That's right. We're seeing a lot more workers actually beginning to say, we've had enough. You're attempting to destroy the service that we love and we work in, and we need to do something to make you listen. And I actually think this is the only thing that will make them listen, but it has to be part of a sustained campaign.
But at the end of the day, all you're surely going to do is get the parents' backs up, who have to try and find somewhere for their children to go for the day while you're on strike.
Well, it's very interesting, because that's not the messages that we've been getting. And yesterday, when HTV News were doing their report, they scoured far and wide to try and find parents who would criticise the teachers' action, and they couldn't find someone. They had to go to Mumsnet in the end, because they couldn't find a local parent, because parents know how hard teachers work and they want those teachers to stay in the classroom. And what Michael Gove is attempting to do is to make teaching an unviable profession for those teachers.
Now, going back to free schools, I mean, you mentioned a couple of schools where there's been problems. I mean, this is actually quite an adventurous thing to do, a bit entrepreneurial in a way. There's bound to be a few hiccups with the free school system, but can't you see that surely it's actually quite a good thing to have more diversity in the different methods of teaching, the different emphasis in different schools, rather than to try and keep every school the same?
Well, let me just give you an example. There's a school, and it's in, I think it was Glamorgan, it was somewhere in Wales, which was opened up as a free school next to a primary school which actually had places for the children. £3.1 million was put into the free school, and there were 40 students in the free school. And what happened in the local neighbouring primary school was that you actually saw a reduction in teachers. We had to actually have a redundancy in that school. Now, to me, that's a waste of money. That £3.1 million could have been much better spent on having smaller class sizes, of having increased resources for those children. So, you know, we don't need free schools to be innovative. Schools are in. If you go into any primary school or any secondary school around the country, you'll see innovation in the classroom all the time. What free schools do, and the worry we have, is some of them employ unqualified teachers only, and that is a huge danger. And that's what we saw with the school recently, which has been in the news.
Well, tell us a bit about you know, what you think should happen, and for example, how much qualification you had, how much teacher training college education you had, and what routes you think that there should be before someone's allowed to become a teacher.
Well, I think the standard we had for years and years, where people had a degree, specialised in a particular subject up to degree level, and then they did a one-year postgraduate teaching qualification where they actually had to do practice their teaching and go back into college or university to be able to develop those skills, was a very good way of doing it. I think bringing people into schools who are unqualified, and let's be honest about this, when we're talking about unqualified, we don't talk about just people who have a degree and have no postgraduate. We can talk about people who have no degree. people can actually teach in schools with no qualification. That's the danger.
But don't
you
accept that some people just happen to be, what, for whatever reason, gifted or naturally good with children?
Yeah, but you have to have the depth of knowledge in your specialism. I mean, it's not just about having a good personality or being good with children. You need specialist knowledge. I mean, I would never consider myself able to go in and teach a child to read in a primary school. I don't have that skill. I haven't been trained to do that. In the same way, I wouldn't expect someone to come in and teach science to my year seven unless they had been trained to do it. It is a specialist. It is a specialist profession.
Well, what about? That's easy to understand when you're talking about secondary school, but in primary schools, I would have thought that actually a lot of it is just about finding someone who's good with children, who's able to motivate the children, and sometimes that may just be to do with play.
Well, I'll give you a really good example. A lot of parents know when their primary school children bring the homework, their maths homework home, the parents can't do it. That's because the way that maths is taught in the primary sector is very different from the way it was taught when I was at school. They're developing a whole new way of trying to get your children to understand numbers rather than just remembering them. And therefore, you have to be trained in order to do that. You have to be up with the latest ideas about education and how children learn. And I think that's really important, and we can't undermine that. People can't be babysitters. We don't want babysitters for our children. We want educators for our children, and I think we've got to fight to hold on to that. It doesn't mean that unqualified people aren't valuable in schools. They're very valuable, and I think every classroom should have a qualified teacher and a teaching assistant, but we can't have just a teaching assistant. We need the qualified teacher as well.
Now, you talked about one of the reasons for having a march in the city and having the strike is actually to do with morale. Tell us how morale's been affected since you started in teaching.
I think people are very, very worn down by the demands of a target-setting culture. Teaching has become very much a target-driven culture.
So how does that work, that target culture?
Well, teachers are set targets at the beginning of the year, and they then obviously are assessed on those targets throughout the year. But sometimes those targets can be very onerous, and it depends on the school you're in and what the head teacher is and whether they're reasonable or not. But sometimes those targets can be very onerous, and people can find it very difficult to keep up with the amount of workload. So I think workload's a big issue. And I think the second big factor is the feeling devalued. We feel we have no professional autonomy anymore left by the government.
But the idea of targets is just making sure you're doing your job. I mean, that's just not, you should expect that, surely.
Of course you should. Of course your targets are reasonable, but what I'm saying to you is that not all the targets that set are reasonable. Some of them are so onerous that it becomes very difficult
give me
for people
example.
To be able to meet them. I mean, I'll give you a classic example that every single child in the class that you teach has to make a 1.5% level of increase within a year. Now, different classes, there are different children with different needs, and you cannot do that for every single child. If you'll do it for some years in the class, it'll be great and it'll work perfectly well. There might be other years where there's difficulties and problems with specific children who have to bring their own problems to the table. There might be another situation where someone, instead of being set three reasonable targets, I've had some primary schools where people have been set 10 or 11 targets. Impossible to manage with the planning and the workload, because the planning now that teachers do for their lessons is phenomenal. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And that's one of the things we're really worried, that Michael Gove is going to take away the little bit of planning time that teachers have been given. And with that gone, it's going to mean an incredible amount more workload.
Isn't it really much more that teachers enjoy going in and doing the teaching in the class, but it's the marking they don't want to do?
No, I don't think that's true, because I think all teachers recognise that the feedback to children is really important. But I mean, the marking's a bit of an example, really, because feedback to young people can be in all sorts of ways. It can be oral feedback, where you sit with a child and go through a piece of work they've done and talk to them about it. But with a target-driven culture, that's not good enough. The feedback has to be visual, it has to be seen, it has to be in their exercise book. So all the feedback that you do, literally, you have to be accountable for, and it has to have some evidence to base it up. And that's a problem, because I think a lot of very valuable feedback to children is the teacher talking to them about what they've been doing.
Now, one of the things you said that the strike was about yesterday was about teachers being asked to work actually beyond the age of 60. Now, I can remember when I was at school, some of the teachers, I don't know if this is they certainly seem to be older than 60 years old. Why shouldn't teachers, if they want to, be able to work over that age?
If teachers want to watch that age, that's absolutely fine. But the problem is that they're being it means that you would not be able to get your pension until you're 68. And if you do go early, your pension is what we call actuarially reduced, which means it gets cut permanently by quite a large amount. Now, I don't actually think it's viable that people will be able to stay in the classroom, because remember, we have lesson observations three times a year. We have continuous assessment on our performance, and part of that performance is pace, that you're able to keep up with the pace of the class. And at 67, 60, I think that might be quite difficult. So I think what we might see is lots of teachers being sacked for not being able to keep up with their level of performance and ending up being very poor pensioners, because they'll have to take the pension when it's reduced.
This is obviously only part of what Michael Gove would like to do, the Education Secretary, if he really wanted to. Where do you think his changes are heading? What kind of vision do you think he's got, Anne, for education in the future?
Very scary vision, really. I think Michael Gove sees education as being a privatised sector. I mean, I don't know if people read in The Guardian on Saturday, where Michael Gove's chief inspector actually said that, you know, it didn't really matter what input children were given, because 70% of the outcome was due to their genetic ability. Now, that's a very scary notion, you know, because as a teacher, I believe that children can develop at all different rates and at different paces. And given the right input, different children might take longer, but they might still be able to get there in the end. So I think Michael Gove's vision is that schools will be run like businesses, where we will have multinationals, big groups running consortiums of schools. And if these measures go through, they'll be able to keep the pay rate very, very low. So you'll have teachers coming in highly qualified, earning £20,000 a year, with inevitably no pay rise for the rest of their professional career. But the academies, chains, these groups of organisations that are running the schools, will be able to veer that profit into making a profit for themselves. And we know that if this government get back in, that's not out of the question. That's one of the ways they may go forward. They will actually see schools being places where profit's made for shareholders, rather than everything being put into the quality of education.
Well, you mentioned there chains of academies. That's certainly the first time I've heard of that. So does that mean that some academy, we're sitting in Bristol City Academy now, maybe we better be careful for what we say, but you know, does that mean that there are businesses that control sort of maybe a few academies in Bristol, some in Birmingham, in London, and they're actually almost like the kind of companies with with branches, you know, as a school in each city?
Exactly. I mean, I'll give you one example. Harris Carpets, you know, have a chain of academies. You know, we have several big big corporations who are able to run chains of academies. I think the biggest chain is about 42 schools in one particular chain. And what we're worried about is, in the future, academies like the one we're sitting in will be taken over by these chains. Because if they become quite profitable then and lucrative, as long as you've done what Michael Gove wants to do and remove the need to pay people proper pay and give them proper conditions of service, they become very lucrative to the private sector to run, because schools are big business. There's lots of money spent in schools. And if you can control the salaries and you can keep down the need to employ qualified staff, then you can make quite a lot of money out of it. And I have no hesitation in thinking that's the way that Michael Gove would like us to go in the future.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I know that your family is also were teachers. This sounds a little bit frightening, doesn't it? This idea of almost like hostile takeover bids for schools. I mean, where are we heading?
Well, we're heading for, like in the US, I understand McDonald's were running a school at one stage, and they're basically training people to work in McDonald's. Because it was a failing school in inner city Chicago, I think. McDonald's takes it over. And so these kids are being trained to be burger flippers. And of course, if they make any trouble, they get kicked out. Is that what we want our schools to be doing for our children?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, though, surely if funding is being slowly wound down, government funding with financial crisis and that kind of thing, surely it's better that McDonald's are teaching our children than nobody is.
Well, that's disputable. But in actual fact, this whole idea of no money, there is no money. There's plenty of money. It's in the Cayman Islands. The bailing out of the banks in 2008 means that the public sector basically has bailed out the private financial system. So we bail out the private financial system so that McDonald's or whoever it is still in business, Harris Carpets. And then Harris Carpets takes the profits that they've made and buys the school system. Now, in actual fact, they're only still in business because we bailed the banks out. So we've got to
get... Hang on, that was Labour that did that?
Well, Labour did that. Because when you bail the banks out, if you're going to bail the banks out, you're supposed to nationalise them properly and take them over. But what we've actually done is just given them a blank cheque. And they've taken that blank cheque, and now they lend the money back to us to pay them back. Do you understand what I'm saying here? This is absolutely silly. So we bail the financial system out, and then we borrow the money from the financial system to pay the financial system back, because we bailed them out. Now, once you've bailed out the financial system, in actual fact, that's the moment where, in actual fact, private capitalism is actually over, and it's been over for several years now. But people are still pretending, like a cartoon character, that we're in the same old world we used to be in. And in actual fact, what they want is everything privatised, including schools, including, for example, Hinkley Point is going to be built by two foreign companies, both of which are run by their governments, France and Communist China. But this whole idea that there isn't any money, we've got to knock this on the head. What we need to do is actually spend more money on schools. We need to put people to work in schools, for example, as teaching assistants. And let's get the class sizes down to a really manageable level, 15 or 10 like they have in the private sector, and then we'll get some real results. And we'll also help. We'll give people work. We'll spend money in the economy. We're building a better future for everybody. And we really are coming to a big choice as a society about what kind of society we're going to live in. It's either going to be run by sharks or it's going to be run by the people. And of course, don't forget that these companies that will take over these schools will be accountable to nobody, the governing bodies, all the rest of it, all out of the window. At the moment, schools are responsible to the local communities they serve.
They may be accountable to shareholders.
Who live in Hong Kong, for example.
Anne, what's the NUT's answer to this question? Because, I mean, you'll be constantly being told there's not enough money, aren't you?
Yeah, well, we share the view. It's about priorities. You prioritise education. And we're not asking for a huge amount of money. We're asking for schools to be democratically accountable. That's really what we're asking for.
Well, in what way are they not now, then?
Well, they're not. It moved towards academisation. We've got nearly 50% of schools in our academies. So they're no longer accountable to the local authority or the local community. The governing body is... They're run basically in the name of three people who are in charge of the academy, if they're a standalone academy. And as I've said already, if they're not a standalone academy, then we have these huge chains. And, and some of them refuse to recognise trade unions. You know, that's a bit of a battle as well. So what the NUT would like to see, well, in their campaign at the moment, in order to defend education, to ensure that we keep qualified teachers in the classroom, is to do the three things that we want, which is to revisit the pension age, because we think 60 is too late. And don't forget that in 2007, we renegotiated our pension payments, so we're paying more into our pension pot. And now the ball game's been switched again. And we want the government to publish the evaluation of the pension scheme, which they've refused to do. We want to have national pay bargaining. I mean, if I work in Tesco's in Eastville or I work in Tesco's in Western Supermare, I get paid the same. Why shouldn't teachers who work in one school or another school not get paid the same? That's what we've got at the moment. That's what we want to keep, and that's what they want to take away from us.
Martin, do you think that there's any possibility with the present government, Liberal Democrats and Conservatives in coalition, that the teachers will be listened to?
Well, I think the real struggle for the teachers is to make sure that they keep the community on side, including the parents and others. And we will take our revenge at the ballot box when the appropriate moment comes.
Anne, how democratic? You mentioned just now about non-recognition of the union in schools. Mm. What difference does it make if a school recognises the union or not?
Well, if the school doesn't recognise the union, then members are basically left on their own. So if there's a problem in the school, then it's very difficult for us as a union to go in and negotiate
with
the management.
Does that just mean that, for example, you can't actually talk to... I mean, surely you can talk to the head teacher, whether you're in a union or whether it's unionised or not.
If you have no standard negotiating rights, then they have no need to talk to you. So if they're going to change any of the conditions of service of the members in that school, they have no need to consult with you. And that's a real worry for members, because if this goes through and we see people changing all the pay policies, which is what they're attempting to do, without any level of consultation, we can see members in a very difficult situation.
Okay, well, we had a one-day strike in large parts of the country yesterday. What's the next stage for your industrial action?
Well, what we've done is, this is the third phase of our strategy. We've been taking regional action, and we've had regional action now all around the country starting in last June. We're also taking part in action short of strike action, which is where we have a list of tasks which before we didn't need to do, and we're asking members if they don't, you know, that they can refuse to do certain bureaucratic tasks, which has no impact on the children and on the teaching, but the bureaucratic tasks. And what we're aiming now is to have a national strike with the NESUWT, and together we make up 90% of the teaching profession. Now, it looks like there are other, as I said earlier, other workers who are preparing to ballot for industrial action as well. And I think what would be really good is if we could give a really big message to this government by taking that action in a coordinated fashion together before Christmas.
Now, Marina Morris has been out on the streets to ask you what you think of the teachers and teaching more generally. So here's what she came up with.
What do you think of today's schools, teaching and teachers?
It's a bit too theoretical, as in you don't really have a lot of young people, especially coming out, having those employability skills or that drive and grit to be able to make their way through the system and find themselves work or set up something for themselves. And I think teachers are lacking in that respect. It isn't fit for purpose, especially today's globalised world. But when you look at it into the foreseeable future, when you look at it 10, 15, 20 years down the line, when you look at these youngsters taking positions of power, taking positions of business, I think that's where you begin to realise that they're wearing well prepared for that, for that environment.
The only connection I have with school is my little sister, who's at school at the moment. I think she struggles with having her own individuality at school, but obviously there has to be some sort of barriers with that.
The college I go to is pretty bad, really. It's quite unorganised. Some colleges and some places are good, amazing in Bristol, but not the one we go to.
Ashley Down.
Oh, some of the teachers are alright, but some just...
But it's really boring. It's so boring, no one really listens. He doesn't engage with you.
The facilities actually in Ashley Down College are good, just the teachers don't do anything.
Yeah, the stuff the council have sort of paid to put in there are really good.
I think education's pretty good, actually. It's pretty good standard, I think. Yeah, good, comprehensive.
I think language education in the UK is not very good. When you compare the way students learn other languages in the UK to European schools or Asian schools. Maybe because English is spoken everywhere, we get very lazy, and so we don't bother learning other people's languages.
I think that people have to decide what kind of educational route they want to take very early in life. So I think people should have more open types of education for longer.
Are academy and free schools a good idea?
Academies, it's allowing people to take ownership and to take charge of quality. But to a greater degree as well, I think there needs to be regulations, because we're talking about education. We need to find a common ground, regulate them to a good degree to make sure that the standards aren't compromised for profits.
No, I think it's better to have schools that have a more uniformed identity, that somebody living in Bristol is having the same quality and standard of education as somebody living in Liverpool, stressing that they should also have a good wide range of subjects and topics politically to cover, and religiously to cover as well.
Yeah, I think they are, because, well, you know, like, what, 80% of the population probably wouldn't be able to pay for private schools or education or college courses.
Is anything missing in today's education?
So they lack the practical skills, in essence. So it's more theoretical, it's more preparing for examinations, not really preparing you for the real world. So in essence, they come out fine. They may even know how to write a CV, but a lot of the youngsters that I work with don't. They move on to the workplace. They don't know what the workplace look like. They don't know the values, you know, they only know the values many a times of what they see on TV and video and they think everything is X factor in the world, but you know, there is sustainability at the end of that.
Possibly jobs, like hunting for jobs, when it all happens when you leave school or college. If they had more knowledge, then it might be easier for them to find what they want to do sooner rather than later.
I think a more individualised agenda.
I think people aren't taught about finances, and students should learn how to fill out tax returns and and how to apply for loans and mortgages, you know, real life skills in today's world, like finances and...
Bob Marley. Why?
Why? Because Bob Marley was an inspiration to everyone.
Okay, an interesting one to finish there with. Not enough Bob Marley in our schools. But Anne, the profits are quite clearly flagged up by a couple of people there as potentially not a good thing about the academy schools. I think one of the points that really hit me listening to that is that there's not enough preparation for the real world. Too theoretical. And I suppose, you know, the subject you teach, chemistry, quite a lot of your pupils will come out and they probably never use that.
Oh, I think they use it all the time because chemistry explains the world around us. And every time they use an Alka-Seltzer, and they'll understand what dissolving means, and they'll be able to understand their lives in a very much more enriched way. Because I don't think education is just about preparing you to do a particular job. It's preparing you to have an enriched life. And I would take issue with a few of those things that were said, because, I mean, I do know, I don't teach it, but they have PSCHE, which is a life skills kind of course, a pastoral course that all students have to do. And they do teach them in Year 11 about tax
forms. What does it stand for?
Pastoral and social education. And they teach them about tax returns, and they teach them other life skills, how to fill in forms, how to read between timetables. All those things do happen. And the other question was really interesting, the young man at the beginning who said, you know, we wonder about how these young people being able to go out and take over business and run the country. Well, unfortunately, from the state sector, if we look at the people we've got at the moment running the country, very few of them ever went to a state school. I think it's 95% of them actually went to the private sector and actually went through Oxford or Cambridge. So that would be no difference. And I would question that. I think the young people that I teach are very savvy and actually have got a lot of determination and grit, and I've had to work very hard. And the big thing about our kids in Britain is they're the highest tested young people in the whole of the world. Nowhere else has as much testing, and that was one of the things I would agree with. We need to take away some of that testing, because to take some of the pressure off the young people and leave some space for a bit more enrichment. But as for school being boring, well, maybe that person's been out of the classroom a little bit, because if you go to, I challenge people to go to majority lessons in schools, they won't be bored. They'll be stimulated and excited by what's happening in the classroom.
What about that point over languages, though? Because, I mean, this is something we often hear about the English, who really just not got their act together in learning foreign languages. Many other countries make sure that children learn at least two other foreign languages.
Yeah, but when do they start learning them in other countries? They start learning them from 5 years old when they go to primary school. We don't do that, and we never have done that. And in fact, actually, it was made a couple of years ago, it was made that foreign languages are no longer a compulsory subject for people to take. So the government and the education department haven't put the value on languages. And if it's not seen to be a valued part of the curriculum, then young people often do switch off. So my answer to that would be it should be really valued, and it should be taught to young people from the very young. When I was at school, we actually learnt French when I was at five. We used to have a little sort of thing that came over the tannoy system twice a week in the morning, and we all went and sang French songs, and it was great. And I think I've got, you know, a lot more of an openness to languages because of that, and I think that's what we should be doing.
Do you like the idea of teaching children with a sort of tannoy system going out around the school? That sounds a bit strange. Martin, just give you the final word on this. What do you think that Michael Gove is going to get his way with, essentially slowly closing down the state sector and opening up schools as independent units and businesses?
That's what they'd like to do, but I think in actual fact what's very interesting is that the Finnish education system tops the world. Everybody agrees that they've got the best results in the entire world. And that what they do in Finland is nobody goes to school until they're seven. They don't go to nursery school until they're seven. They don't even start teaching them to read until they're seven. All children go to the schools, all schools are comprehensive, all classes are mixed ability to the age of 18. And it's only at 18 that you get your first test in Finland. So we start testing age five. In Finland, nobody gets an external test until they're 18. But with all the freedom that they have and their approach to learning through play for the youngest, a completely comprehensive system and all the rest of it, completely different from Michael Gove's vision, but they are the best in the world. And that is the standard that we should be pursuing. And all this stuff about making classrooms relevant and all the rest of it, Finnish classrooms are absolutely relevant. There are no tests at all until you're 18. Well, Not at all.
I said I was going to give you the last word, but Anne, one other thing I should ask you is what about this whole, you know, I can remember hearing those that can't teach. It's a bit of a nasty thing to say, but there are a lot of people in teaching who have never, ever worked in the outside world. I mean, that's one of the things which is bound to happen by bringing unqualified people into schools, is you are going to get people who have worked out there in the commercial world.
But schools are a community. There's always been people in schools, and there always will be, who aren't the teachers, who have done other things. We have lots of office staff, we have clerical support staff, we have lots of other people in schools who have had other experiences. And I don't think it's true that teachers just these days go into teaching. I think you'll find a lot of teachers to support themselves have done all kinds of other work in order to get themselves to the position that they're in.
Okay, well, back in the, I don't know if I should really say back in the real world, but back in the Westminster world of politics, we go to Prime Minister's questions now. And this week, Ed and Dave were doing almost the same sort of thing as they were doing last week, having a bit of Barney about energy prices and the cost of living.
I think the British people will be very surprised to hear the Prime Minister telling them that their living standards are rising when they know the truth. Under him, living standards are falling month upon month upon month. And there is a cost of living crisis, and one of the reasons is rising energy bills, which one leading charity reports today is one of the things driving people to food banks. In light of that, does the Prime Minister think that the energy company SSE's decision to raise its customers' energy bills by 8.2% is justified?
Well, first of all, let me come back to him on the youth unemployment figures, which he mentions, because the youth claimant count, the number of young people claiming unemployment benefit, is down 79,000 since the election. Now, there's absolutely no complacency. We need more young people in work. We need more jobs. But one of the remarkable things about today's figures is they show for the first time there are 1 million more people in work than there were when this government came to office. And let me remind the Right Honourable Gentleman of something he predicted in October 2010. He said the government, I think people want to listen to this, he said this, the government have a programme which will clearly lead to the disappearance of 1 million jobs. That was his prediction. He was 100% wrong, and he should apologise to this House of Commons. We all want to see energy prices come down. That's why we are putting people on the lowest tariff. But the one thing that won't work is a price con, and that is what he's recommending.
Martin, a price con?
Well, it's good knockabout stuff, this, isn't it? The cost of living crisis is definitely there. What we've got now, got different from what we had in the 80s, is the flexibilised labour market means that the hit is taken through real wages rather than through unemployment. So what we're now finding is lots of people are in work, but they're earning very little above benefit level. Many of people who are in work, of course, are still on working tax credit, so they are in fact still benefit recipients, taking housing benefit and so on.
Oh, and David Cameron's pointing out there 1 million more people in work. I mean, that surely is a good thing.
Yes, but normally you would expect a capitalist economy to keep expanding anyway. This is what people have got to realise. We've still got an economy which is smaller in real terms than it was before the crash. So one more million people in work means that productivity per worker has dramatically fallen. Now that means, in other words, instead of producing high quality stuff, teachers, engineers and all the rest of it, we've got a million more jobs on 0 hours contracts and people basically earning very little above the poverty line. Now this is an American system. If you see what I mean. We're ending up a situation where there's lots of people in work because they've got no other choice, but the kind of work they're doing is completely unsatisfactory. And of course, in Scandinavia, places like Finland, they make sure that there are no rubbish jobs. All they've got is good jobs because they've planned their economy over many years to make sure that's how it works. We do everything cheap and cheerful in Britain. Cheap and cheerful.
Now, Anne, from the National Union of Teachers, what are your thoughts on the energy prices and just generally the cost of living, which has been discussed there?
Well, I think it's an absolute disgrace. I think for these energy companies to be putting up the price of their products by 8.2%, I think 10% is the other one we've heard, when people have had pay freezes for the past 3 years is absolutely deplorable.
But in a way, it's just exactly kind of reacting to what Ed Miliband was saying a couple of weeks ago when he said, I'm going to freeze energy prices. Well, the energy companies actually can fix energy prices wherever they want. This is going to be very nice for their shareholders. They can just put them up if they want
to. But that's the problem, isn't it? That's the real problem. And if we get to the nut of this problem, what we need to do is we need to be nationalising energy. Because if the energy companies were nationalised, then the whole section of the money wouldn't be taken out and passed over to shareholders as profit. Because I think if you look on the website of these companies, you'll see they're still making millions and millions of pounds in profit that they're passing on to the shareholders. And I think that's completely and utterly unacceptable. And we have to wake up and recognise this has not worked. We need to go back and we need to nationalise these companies.
Well, in today's Mirror, Chris Weston, it says, who's the boss of British Gas, is refusing to give up his £2 million bonus, Martin. Any chance of nationalising his company?
Ultimately, yes, but I don't think it'll happen until we've had a major stock market crash, which nearly happened today, actually. If it looks as if the Republicans hadn't backed down in the US yesterday, we could have had a crash today. And that, of course, would then have put all of these companies... And, of course, once you start putting a price fix on companies, they start to lose money. And that's how you nationalise companies. That's how they nationalised the oil industry in Venezuela or whatever. You regulate it so much that eventually they can't make any money and they hand it back into the public sector. These things should never have been privatised in the first place.
Yes, but you can't turn back the clock. I mean,
yes,
British Gas, Centrica, has made 1.58 billion operating profit this year.
Yes, well, when you say you can't turn back the clock, yes, you can. For example, in New Zealand, the Labour government privatised the railways and then a subsequent Labour government renationalised them. And in the third world, industries are being nationalised as we speak. It's quite possible, for example, it's not quite clear what's happening in Egypt, but it's quite possible that some industries will be nationalised. Nationalisation is definitely back on the agenda in the second decade of the 21st century. And the Tories would like to say that it isn't, but I'm afraid it is. We've just nationalised the entire banking system, effectively. So we've got to recognise that all this privatisation talk is talk, and it's basically profiteering at the expense of the majority. And we've now got a bizarre situation where, with Hinkley C, where they're talking about bringing in the nationalised EDF energy from France and the Chinese communist run energy company from China to run our energy system. So it's a privatised market system run by foreign communist state-owned companies. It's just bizarre.
Okay, well, let's go to Labour MP this time, Stephen Hepburn, at Prime Minister's Question, who's accusing the Conservative Party of simply being a political front for the hedge funds.
Stephen Hepburn.
On yourself.
Tax cuts for millionaires. Tax cuts for the wealthiest companies in this country. A bonus bonanza in the city. At the same time as millions are denied the right to work, and those people who are hard working in work have had their pay cut by £1,500. When is this government made up of privileged, privately educated millionaire ministers going to do something and get in the real world instead of being the political front of the hedge funds and the bankers in the city?
Well, we all know who did the most for the hedge funds and the bankers. It was the people who allowed the banks to go bust in the first place. It is this government that is cutting taxes for working people, taking 2.7 million people out of tax, compared with the disgrace of the government he was in that scrapped the 10p income tax.
Well, that's an interesting exchange, isn't it? What is the name of that Labour MP? Because
Stephen Hepburn.
Stephen Hepburn, I must remember that, because that was a fairly to-the-point rant.
From Merseyside somewhere.
Well, he sounds like he's from the North East, but he's certainly not from Eton College, is he? Like the Prime Minister. Basically, blaming the Labour Party for the collapse of the banking system in Wall Street is ridiculous. Absolutely absurd. The Labour Party were responsible for not doing enough to regulate the banking
sector. He's not doing that, Martin. What he's saying is that Gordon Brown didn't deal with the situation properly.
He didn't. He should have nationalised the banks. You know, in 1983, the longest suicide note in history, when Michael Foote led us into defeat in that year, he called for the scrapping of Trident and the nationalisation of the banking industry. What a ridiculous idea. Nationalise the banking industry. Nutcase. And then what happens? 20 years later, oh, we nationalised the banking industry. If we'd done it in 1983, it would have been a great deal cheaper than it turned out to be in 2008. And in actual fact, that's the problem with the Labour Party, is they stopped being the Labour Party and decided they were going to be Tory light. And that is absolutely correct.
Anne from the NUT, what are your thoughts on this idea that he's putting forward there, Stephen Hepburn? And it sounds almost like a kind of conspiracy theory, you know, the Tories are just a political front for the hedge funds and the city.
Well, I think a bit of evidence from this week is the post office privatisation. We've actually seen them undervalue yet again another public service that belonged to us as taxpayers. We paid for this, it belonged to us, and it's been sold for less than half what it's actually recouped in terms of the shares that they've bought. I think it's an absolute disgrace, and I'm delighted to see that the postal workers have come out, and just this figure's a very interesting figure. 63% return on the ballot for strike action, and how many councillors in the city have been elected on a 63% turnout? I think something's beginning to shift. I think ordinary people out there are beginning to become aware of what this government's about, and they're in it for their cronies, really. You know, we've seen it time after time after time, and it's about time we had to fight back.
Meg Hillier brought to the Prime Minister's attention food banks.
Meg Hillier!
Mr. Speaker, the number of people helped by food banks in 2012-13 was triple compared with the previous year. Is the Prime Minister proud of this achievement?
Well, food bank usage went up 10 times under the last Labour government. Of course, what I want to see is helping all families with their living standards. That is why we should recognise the fact we're getting more people into work, we're growing our economy, we're keeping interest rates down, and crucially, we're cutting taxes. Four things that are vital to living standards, and four things you'd never get from a Labour government.
Well, Martin, I think he got her there. I mean, he's saying, well, it's all very well saying that food banks have gone up three times, but under Labour, it was 10 times.
Yes, but just basic statistics. Something going up 10 times from a very small base doesn't really mean very much, but going up three times from a very high base means a great deal. I mean, especially in 1 year, for three times the number of people to be going to food banks, pretty much shows what the struggle is. What is interesting from an economics point of view, and I used to teach A-level economics, what is interesting about what's happening is because of the flexibilisation of the labour market we brought in under Thatcher and then underpinned by New Labour, the shock of the crash is not being felt through unemployment. In the 1980s, those who were in the core of the economy for, you know, stable jobs with long-term contracts were able to keep their wages relatively in line with inflation, and the real pain was suffered by whole industries being wiped out, like the coal industry and the steel industry and so on. What we're seeing this time in the flexibilised labour market and the flexibilised globalised economy that Britain has now become is that what's happening is that people's wages are being cut rather than unemployment taking. And we've still got, don't forget, unemployment went up massively during the crash. And all that's happening now is it's coming down a little bit. And there's an argument about how you measure it as well, to be honest. But in other words, we've still got a core. For example, there are still nearly 1 million people under the age of 25 unemployed. That's not really changing. It's not going anywhere. That's a whole generation written off, and that is pretty similar to the 80s, but it's not as bad as some economists forecast. Because of the flexibilised labour market, companies are keeping workers on but just cutting their wages. In the past, it was very hard to cut real wages. It's not hard anymore. Everybody's wages are being squeezed, but the macroeconomic impact is exactly the same. They are draining demand out of the economy. Let's just make this absolutely clear. The economy now in Britain is still smaller than it was before the crash. And in other words, we're marking time, we're treading water, waiting for the Wall Street crash, which will come sometime soon. It could have been today, might be next week, might be after Christmas. But when it does come, it's going to make 2008 look like a walk in the park. People need to be prepared. The Labour front bench needs to understand this as well. We need to prepare. We're on an aeroplane that's crashing. We need to adopt the crash position. We're all arguing about what's in the food and whether we can have an extra drink from the stewardesses. In actual fact, the plane's crashing.
Shouldn't we actually be putting our parachutes on rather than waiting?
Well, you can't just parachute out of an economy, can you? But I mean, the point is that the whole political class tends to talk as if everything's basically all right, and we're just arguing over you know, how we're going to distribute the pie. In actual fact, what they don't want to tell people is, in actual fact, capitalism is in a serious, serious, basically terminal crisis, and we need to start thinking outside the box.
Okay, Anne, this whole business of food banks, have you found that it affects some of your parents? Have you found that it actually affects communities you're working in?
Well, I know that schools have been asked to identify any students they may have concerns about who may benefit and who may need to be referred to local food banks in communities. I know that's been happening in schools. I think the thing that's really ironic is that we are actually the seventh richest country in the world, and we have people having to stand in queues outside shops right down the end of the street to get a hot meal to eat because they cannot manage either on the benefits they've got or the other myth that's around is the whole thing about increased employment. There's a huge increase in part-time work. There's a lot of people out there on part-time work and they're not getting enough money to be able to feed their families and pay their bills and pay the bedroom tax, and therefore they're resorting to having to go to these food banks. And I think for the seventh richest country in the world, is an absolute disgrace.
Another problem is, in some parts of the country, is simply having funding for running proper ambulance services. The health service is having all sorts of problems, but ambulance services too. And the MP, Laura Lee Burt, put this question to the Prime Minister on Wednesday.
Mr. Speaker, in September, Solihull's ambulance service moved to a make-ready system. And today there are no two-man ambulances based in the borough. Already several of my constituents have been left for totally unacceptably long periods waiting for an ambulance to take them to hospital. Talking to ambulance chiefs is like a dialogue of the deaf. So will the Prime Minister agree to meet with me to see what can be done before a constituent dies waiting for an ambulance to come?
I absolutely share my honourable friend's concern about the importance of response times for ambulances. I think we then have to task the NHS for how best they meet those targets, because what matters most of all is swift attendance to people who need it. Very happy to arrange a meeting with her and health ministers to look at this. I know the West Midlands Ambulance Service is looking at the way to improve its ambulance services, and clearly she will encourage them to do just that.
A bit worrying, Martin, isn't it? Ambulance services seem to be just being not funded properly at the moment.
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, the whole idea that there is no money and we've got to talk about what we're going to cut misses the point. What we really need to do is have a vision of where we're going as a society.
But has the Labour Party got a vision?
Not yet. What's started to happen is that the Labour grassroots have started to realise that we can't just work within the framework that's been laid down to us by the City of London, the military-industrial complex, our international alliances of the United States and Israel. But, on the other hand, you've got to remember that the propaganda, that, you know, shows like this where we go into detail about the underlying problems are relatively rare. Most of what people are fed most of the time is basically propaganda, and it leads to a real problem with just getting people to understand what the basic issues are. So we've got a mountain to climb. We shouldn't kid ourselves. Out there in the real world, people are confused and frightened. And of course, we've got people like the English Defence League and other extremists who are building up, and the Golden Dawn in Greece and so on, who are working on people's fears. But we need a socialist vision for the future. And in the Labour Party in the past, and I've been a member since 1975, we were unashamed to talk about having a socialist vision. We've got to get back to having those kind of conversations.
Well, I know, Anne, you know, you've talked a little bit about a sort of socialist vision, I don't know whether you call it or not, that or not, for teaching. What's the union's vision for actually bringing that about? Because at the end of the day, it's no good just talking about saying we don't like what's going on. You've got to have your own vision.
Yeah, of course, and the NUT has always not just been a union that campaigns on grounds of teachers' pay and conditions. We've always campaigned on grounds of educational ideology, and the NUT was very instrumental in opposing SATs when they were brought in, because we felt yet more testing for young people was actually going to derail.
But why are you so against SATs?
Well, because what they were done is they were set up and used as a way of not helping young people to progress, but to judge school against school, and they were used in the league tables, and that's actually caused a lot of problems in schools and a lot of pressure, not just on young people but on teachers and head teachers, because these results are being used to judge the schools. So instead of having an enriched education, what you were finding quite a lot is that schools were just focusing on trying to get the kids to jump through these hoops, and that's to me, that's detrimental to education. So the NUT has a very clear vision about about education and where we see it going in the future.
Okay, thanks very much. So this week's guest, that was Clevedon teacher and NUT elected member for the Union's National Executive in the South West, Anne Lemon. After the news, if you're not in a traffic jam already, slow down and ask yourself, who's in control of your car?
3.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.